It may be that the secret to living in space is bringing life into space. You're listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Hello and welcome back for another conversation here on Western Worlds, an AFM original show heard right here on astronomy.fm. My name is Raymond Francis, and I'm coming to you this week, as every week, from the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University in London, Ontario, Canada. It's difficult enough to make machines work in space. Vacuum, extreme temperatures, and harsh radiation aren't friendly to mechanical and electronic systems. But despite the challenges, after a few decades, we've become fairly good at making durable, reliable satellites and spacecraft systems. Geostationary communication satellites, for example, routinely run out of fuel before experiencing other failures. But the human body can't be so easily adapted to the space environment, and to let humans work in space, we have to provide a suitable environment for them. We've begun to make progress. The International Space Station has been inhabited for over a decade, but it still requires frequent resupply of food, air, and water from the Earth. Missions beyond Earth orbit won't be able to rely on such resupply, nor carry enough consumables for lengthy missions of months and years. Here on Earth, we rely on the external environment to provide food, oxygen, and clean water. Matthew Bamsey, a postdoctoral researcher at DLR, the German Aerospace Center, is researching ways to use a key aspect of that environment, plant life, as an integral part of new life support systems for crews on long-duration space missions. I spoke with Dr. Bamsey by internet link at his home in Bremen, Germany. So, Dr. Bamsey, good evening and welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Raymond.
So you're working in life support systems for space missions, and I guess my first question would be what that encompasses. What functions does a system like that, are we considering it to be taken care of?
Perfect. Yeah, life support can often be confused on a Google search for a hospital-related life support, but in this particular instance, we deal with providing life support for astronauts. And in this instance, we're talking about providing air, food, and water for crews. And obviously, as missions increase in duration, we're going to have to carry more and more air, food, and water for those crews. And so our particular work primarily deals with how we can look at carrying enough supplies or potentially regenerating some of those supplies over such long-duration missions. So yeah, in our instance, life support is very much providing air, food, and water, whether that be through technologies or through other means, which I'm sure we'll get into this evening.
Okay, so air, food, and water. Then how? What's the state of the art? How are we doing that on present-day spacecraft?
That's a great question. Yeah, present-day spacecraft, at least in recent decades, has definitely been take up what you need and provide no recycling whatsoever. And so, you know, the missions of Apollo, the early Gemini missions, Mercury, of course, short-duration missions, you know, you're taking up the water in tanks, you're taking up the air and nitrogen refill that you may need, and you're taking up the food. On the International Space Station, things have definitely improved from that perspective. There is quite a bit of regeneration, especially from the water perspective, because water is, besides propellant, the biggest consumable that a space mission will have. And of course, the more crew that you have, the more water you're going to need. The International Space Station does have a water recovery system, which is recycling a lot of the water that the crew is using, and that primarily input to that system is condensate, so capturing the water out of the air in the International Space Station and then putting that through the water recovery system, then the crew can reuse that water. But the water recovery system also incorporates urine processor assembly, which can regenerate somewhere in the ballpark of 70% of that liquid back into usable water for the crew. So things are definitely moving in the direction of more closure to some of these systems. But there's a lot left for us to do if we're starting to talk about even longer duration missions, such as missions to Mars.
So you're saying that urine recycling system is something like 70% recovery. How good is the water system overall on the ISS?
The numbers vary for that, but I think one good marker of the water recovery system in general is that the mass that was required for the hardware making up the water recovery system and some of the early consumables paid for itself in the water that it recycled in about 8 to 9 months, if I'm not mistaken. So right there, you're regenerating a lot of water, and it's already paid for itself many fold since this hardware has been up there. That hardware requires a lot of mechanical and physical chemical processes to work fine. So there's a lot of moving parts and issues in terms of breakdowns that can obviously happen. So reliability is definitely a factor over long duration missions applying some of that technology. So, you know, the ISS is a great testbed for trialing some of these technologies out over these long durations that we're fortunate to be able to test them for. But overall, the water recovery system aims to regenerate somewhere in the ballpark of 85 to 95% water.
Which is pretty ambitious.
Which is pretty ambitious and actually pretty good. So, and again, because water is so heavy, if we're talking about, you know, $10,000 a pound to low Earth orbit, and you're talking about a small juice box, for example, on the station, you're already talking on the order of $3,000 for that 300 milliliters. So obviously regenerating some of that water, ensuring that we can support these long duration missions without having to resupply the station so many times is, of course, such a big benefit.
And is it just that water is so massive that makes it such an important thing to recycle, or are there other considerations here?
Water is just, you know, heavy itself, but it's the amount of water the crew will use as well. Of course, on station and when you're talking about longer duration missions, there is an intent to crew members know that they can't just grab as much water from the station as they want to do whatever they want. So there is a, you know, somewhat of a restriction on water use. So you know, showers on station are not an option. Yes, Skylab did have a small shower that the crew was able to use from time to time, but on station there is no opportunity to have a shower. And so limiting crew water use is quite something that's important, obviously, to the extent that comfort is possible. So again, when we discuss long duration missions where crew psychology and crew dynamics and just making sure the crew is happy, you know, water can play into some of those factors. If you're limiting water too much, then from a hygiene perspective, the crew can struggle with some psychological aspects. So if you look at some of these missions such as Inspiration Mars, planning a flyby mission to Mars and coming back to Earth on a free return, you know, you can see it in some of the numbers in terms of what they restrict water use to, something on the order of 3 to 4 liters per person per day for a crew.
Which is, I guess, just a little more than the ISS has now.
That's correct. Yep, somewhere in that ballpark, definitely, Raymond.
Okay, so this is a question of water, but what about food and air? Have we made any progress in recycling on orbit?
On the air front, there is some regeneration of some of the oxygen and different gases that can be used. In particular, one useful means, not necessarily a way to recycle, but when you're looking at the airlock on station, of course, you know the crew is going to eventually go out of that airlock, so they need to bring the airlock down to vacuum. Well, on previous spacecraft, that air would just be vented to vacuum, for example. Now, there are means to be able to recover some of that atmosphere, so it can be, of course, put back into the airlock when the crew comes back in. So there's some great means from that perspective, and there are a number of other processes that are utilized, but food is really one of the open questions. At this point, we have no good way to recycle or really generate food using mechanical or physical chemical means. And so this is where some of the other work that we do with respect to biological life support becomes really important, because when you are starting to talk about missions on the order of several years, food recovery or food regeneration becomes also extremely important to provide the air, food, and water closure, so you don't have to bring tons and tons of food, which makes even launching such a mission difficult.
So what's the strategy then? How do you bring biology into this process?
So we're fortunate to have here on Spaceship Earth a great example of how we as people are able to use biology to provide food. In this case, you know, hopefully we see it on our dinner plate each night with respect to fruits and vegetables, for example. So for long duration missions, the premise is to also take some of these systems where we can grow wheat, we can grow tomatoes, we can grow lettuce, and actually use the food that is produced in these systems to feed the astronauts. But the real luxury of these systems, such as you know, you can envision on a greenhouse on the lunar surface, is really the fact that they can provide air, food, and water closure. So from a water perspective, plants will take up dirty water in their root system and then transpire that water through leaves primarily. And we can capture that water just like we do on the International Space Station through condensate. And that water is more or less, after a little bit more treatment, ready for use. So that's water. On the atmospheric side, plants bring in just what we exhale. They bring in the CO2 and put out oxygen for us during the day when they're exposed to light. And so we can also use that for atmospheric closure and food. It's pretty obvious that, you know, we're every day hopefully eating fruits, vegetables, and so they provide food closure for us as well. So for long duration space flight on the order of several years, biological systems are the way to go. They're a little ways out there from a technology readiness level perspective at this point, but down the road, this is an important area of research for sure.
And how do you imagine fitting this into to a spacecraft system? Is it enclosed in its own module, or how do you organize such a cultivation system?
That's a great question, Raymond. And there's different groups that have, I guess you would say, different ideas with how these sort of modules can be incorporated. And so some early work, and there are even right now on board station some small plant growth chambers, more or less, such as the Russian LADA, and there's also the ABERS unit, the NASA ABERS Advanced Biological Research System, which different principal investigators can grow crops in to see how these plants are exposed or how they respond to the novel environment of microgravity. So on a small scale side, we can do some science on board station. When we're talking about starting to provide some more, I guess, incentive for the crew from a dietary perspective, then we can start to think about systems such as a salad machine, as they're termed, which is more or less a refrigerator-sized plant growth chamber. And these were proposed primarily by some guys from NASA Ames, Mark Kliss included. And that's a great concept where you just bring a small little plant growth chamber and provide more, supplement the crew diet with herbs and the like from that perspective. But when we're speaking about really trying to help close up these three loops that we talked about, air, food, and water, then we're starting to talk about large plant growth systems, large areas. In fact, the numbers vary between researchers, but you can consider about 20 to 70 meters squared of crop area. So let's say 50 meters squared of crop area per person to close up the air, food, and water loop. So if you have a crew of six staying on the lunar surface permanently, if you didn't want to provide any resupply to them, you would need 300 meters squared of plant growth area. And that is quite a large area just to provide that. So it's a significant initial cost to your mission, but it does mean that in theory, you never have to resupply those crew members.
Yeah, and maybe you could build that in modularly. You could, a little bit then growing over time as the base became more self-sufficient.
Actually, that's also true, Raymond. That's a great point, because one also perspective on this is you probably wouldn't want just 300 meters squared of lettuce. And there's various groups addressing, I guess, the most optimal growth conditions for these candidate crops, as they're referred. So there's a various lists of, okay, if we're going to run a space mission here to Mars, we're going to be on the surface for 500 days, or it's going to be a sustained presence on the lunar surface, for example. These are the crops that we would incorporate into this biological life support system. And because there are various crops and each take different optimal growing conditions, it would likely be quite modularized. And that, from a reliability perspective, is also an important question. The other considerations that play into some of these factors as well, which University of Guelph also specializes in, is low pressure plant growth. And, you know, here on Earth, typically, yes, we have examples of low pressure plant growth on higher mountain ranges, for example. But when we're discussing bringing plants into a spaceflight environment, some of future space vehicles may not be at one atmosphere, or we actually may choose to have a lunar plant growth system at reduced pressure because it reduces the structural mass of the system. And so you may have different modules at reduced pressure and even potentially pressures too low for a crew to be very comfortable in. So this modularized approach is also an important one from some of these perspectives as well.
Okay. And so you mentioned the idea of too much lettuce maybe not being appropriate. Are you looking at multiple organism type systems, several different species of plants, or do you treat them all as distinct units? Is there a sense in combining several species together to make a better system?
Yes, there is a good sense of, I guess, what the suite of appropriate crops to bring with you are. And that varies between space agency. It varies between research group, but there's a good slate of, you know, you have your wheat listed on there, you have your tomato, pepper, lettuce, soybean. And so those are the big ones that sort of pop up on all of those lists. And so definitely from one, just from a dietary perspective, it's important to have varied diet, but also from a just management perspective of these crops, it's nice to have a number of different crops that wheat, you can really grow at high light intensities and get a lot of production out of it. So there's benefits of different crops. Some of them require more work. And another consideration that factors in is just how much crew time is it going to take to look after such a greenhouse or biological life support system? Because as you know, you know, if you're sending a crew to Mars, you're not going to want them spending the entire day in the greenhouse. You're going to want them out there on the surface doing the geology and the biological research that they've been sent there for. And so that's another consideration for future systems, is how automated they will be robotics-wise, et cetera. And so from a Canadian perspective, the Canadian Space Agency, University of Guelph, and Simon Fraser University, with some other support as well, including the Mars Institute, were working on the Arthur Clark Mars Greenhouse. And that's a greenhouse that was located on Devon Island, and that facility does still exist, but is focused on automated plant production. And really, people, we were there on site often for about 3 weeks in July, and for the rest of the year, the greenhouse would be operated remotely. And so we'd grow plants for several months after we left Devon Island. And in the following, after the dark season or after winter, we'd send a command by satellite to start up the greenhouse. And so when we'd arrive the following July, you know, the greenhouse would in theory be full with plants for the field members and field team that would be starting that field season. So Canada does have some good expertise in that area as well.
And how successful was that robotic production? Were you able to get a useful crop?
It was quite successful for a number of years. We had a few interesting occurrences. One thing you don't have to deal with on Mars that you do in the Canadian Arctic is polar bears. And so one year, I think it was 2006, we had a polar bear who decided to put a hole in the side of the greenhouse and tip over some of our growth trays. And so if we would have started the pump, all of the water that we had in our system would have gone on the ground. And so that season was more or less a scientific write-off. But yes, we did have several field seasons where we were able to remotely operate the greenhouse and get a reasonable crop after departing and also upon arrival. So from a learning perspective, it's a great analog environment, a space analog environment, where you cannot easily, one, when you're on site, go to a hardware store to pick up something that may be broken, for example, and two, if there is something that's broken and you've already left the site, it's an expensive endeavor to go back and fix it. And so from a learning perspective, when we're going to send these things eventually to the lunar surface, you can have a lot of operational experience here terrestrially.
Yeah, it seems like a great sort of intermediate test environment.
Yeah, it was. And in fact, there are other analog sites, and that's some of the work that we're focused on here at the German Aerospace Center in Bremen here at the Institute of Space Systems. We're looking at other analog environments. One in particular is the Antarctic, and deploying a reasonably sized plant growth module to the German research station Neumayer 3, which is a pretty unique Antarctic research station in itself. And, you know, they have a summer crew that is there during the summer, and then they also have 9 crew members that overwinter there. And so a facility providing fresh produce over that long winter period is also a benefit from a psychological perspective as well.
So what about tests on orbit? Does weightlessness provide a particular challenge to cultivating plants?
Excellent question. And that is a research area that requires still a lot of investigation. There are a lot of effects that do occur. I was fortunate during some previous postdoc work to be working with two leaders on the edge of that field, Robert Furrell and Annalisa Paul from University of Florida, and they assess how plants respond genetically, for example, to changes to the microgravity environment that they're put into, and developing in particular some imaging systems to be able to capture some of that change in real time. And so overall, though, experiments have shown from many different researchers, there were some initial trials and tribulations, difficulties growing plants on orbit on the Mir space station, for example, and in other places, closed because of the closed environment of space. And when you're in a closed capsule, the one issue that was happening to these early experiments was very high concentrations of ethylene, for example, because you have this closed environment of the spacecraft. You know, your plants and other things may be giving off some of these volatiles, which can then impact the plant growth. And so in one sense, yes, they were worried that the planets were not responding well to microgravity, and that was thought to be the issue. But in fact, the primary issue was actually elevated concentration of ethylene, for example, which was hurting the plants. And now there have been many occasions now where plants have been grown successfully seed to seed. And now when you see images back from onboard station during a harvest, for example, you definitely see some very nice crops. There's definitely still some issues from a technology point of view. You know, from one perspective is just how do you successfully bring the water to the root zone of plants? You know, that is a challenge from a doing so in a way that's, I guess, inert or doesn't require any power. Because as you know, in a microgravity environment, water likes to go anywhere more or less. You can't use gravity to move the water like you do on terrestrially here on future planetary surface greenhouses. But overall, the theme is that, yet plants can be grown successfully in a microgravity environment. There are definitely changes that occur, but from a large-scale production point of view, if we're talking about a 300-meter-squared greenhouse on the lunar surface or in a microgravity environment, anything is feasible for sure.
Okay. And I'm just curious about that ethylene. This is a gas that's implicated in ripening of plants and things like this. How is it becoming a problem?
That is definitely true. And, you know, bananas give off a lot of ethylene. So if you throw them into a drawer in your desk, for example, and open it up, you know, they will ripen much more quickly. So plant ethylene itself is a plant hormone. And so it does have a biological effect on crops, for example. And so that, just like many other gases, many other things can affect plant growth that when you look at a plant on Earth, many things you don't have to worry about. But in a closed environment of spaceflight, you have to very much start to worry about some of these considerations. And the other thing that, which is quite interesting from a space environment perspective, a very new research area is the use of LEDs or light emitting diodes for plant growth experiments. And one way to minimize power use onboard station, for example, or in these future plant growth systems, is to use LEDs that are very much just tuned to chlorophyll absorbance or where the plants are actually absorbing light. So if you see some of the new images of plants being grown under LEDs, often they appear purple because growers can remove the green light, which plants often themselves don't use. That's why the plants often appear green to us, because that's reflected green light. And so from an LED perspective, you can just provide the red and blue light that they need, get all the input energy that you're putting into your lights really goes into the plant for growth. And so we can start to talk about more and more efficient plant growth systems as well.
Well, that's pretty exciting. So I guess as a final thought, then, how close are we getting these three systems to be closed, air, food, and water?
Well, from closing them up from a biological perspective, we're definitely still some years out. The technology has been demonstrated in a number of terrestrial field trials, even as far back as the 70s, for example. And we know the technology and the processes work. From a reliability perspective, there are definitely some things that need to be worked out. But there are active research groups, such as the one here at DLR or the German Aerospace Center, that are focused on that. And there are as well in Canada with University of Guelph and ComDev putting and leading the charge as well from that perspective. A lot of things still need to be worked out. This is one of, I guess, the areas that from a space exploration perspective is always sitting sort of 20 years out. So because it's often not a near-term priority, because we're not talking about missions on the order of several years at this perspective, in terms of going back to Mars or going to Mars in a sustainable way, where, you know, you have a 5-year duration mission, which is really where these biological life support systems become important from a food closure perspective. The schedule isn't on the critical path at this particular perspective, but for sure it's a needed technology for long duration spaceflight. And most importantly, work in this area really has direct terrestrial benefit. From a Canadian perspective, this is the ability to provide fresh produce to our northern communities, which when you look into the supermarkets or the co-ops in these remote communities in Nunavut or Northwest Territories of the Yukon, you know, the prices are exorbitant and shipping costs are extreme. And so the ability to produce produce in a harsh environment such as the Canadian North is a direct terrestrial benefit that research in this particular biological life support domain in this, from a space exploration, can provide terrestrially. So the work in this area is important, and it will continue for sure.
Yeah, and I think those kinds of terrestrial spin-offs would be great to see in northern Canada for sure. Well, thanks for talking to us, and hopefully we'll hear more and see more production in this world of biological support to life support.
Well, I appreciate the interest, Raymond, and look forward to chatting with you in the future as well.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Let's go to the discussion.
So it sounds like from Dr. Bamsey's work that we've already learned quite a lot about how to make life support systems work for spacecraft, but that there's a long way to go yet.
Yeah, not quite at that entirely closed loop, I suppose.
Yeah, I think that's quite a ways off, full loop closure. Trying to completely recycle all of those different, you know, the air and the water and the food,
mm-hmm.
that's not easy. I don't even know if it's easy to do even with plants in the loop.
Yeah, I mean, it's especially when we're talking about long-term durations, like trips to Mars or mm-hmm. beyond. Those kind of things are what we would like to know. Because if you are sending, let's say for a five-term mission, which you was talking about, you really need a food, water, even just to get yourself to Mars before you actually start, you know, terraforming it, making it to what you want. But even just getting there and getting all those resources on board for those amount of time, if we don't know how we're going to recycle even use each material that we are taking, it's going to be hard.
Yeah, you have to do this kind of mass budget and this cycle budget. There's a lot of uses for things like water and a lot of places mm-hmm. that can get lost and diverted, and plants can give you something, but it's a complicated process to manage.
Yeah, there are an awful lot of factors, and then that other side of it with not wanting to have excess waste, because where are you going to put the waste? There's not mm-hmm. to be able to reuse absolutely everything. I mean, we have certainly not mastered that here on Earth, but think about the implications when we do finally master that for space, the implications back here on Earth, how that'll be able to impact people all over the world, really, too.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we have big cities that take in water and other materials and then put it back out into the environment, often treated, sometimes not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And clearly, it has to be treated right back to the level of usability again for a closed cycle. So I expect there will be all kinds of applications of these technologies here on Earth.
Yeah, especially where there's scarce water resources to be able to continuously reuse whatever you are able to find. Countries and even parts of countries, cities, whatever, certain regions where mm-hmm. there's less water available. I mean, that's just hugely efficient to be able to recycle everything that you have with minimal energy usage. So
yeah, of course, which is minimal energy use is being important in space, but also an increasing concern here on Earth.
Absolutely.
I'm imagining there's lots of desert places in the world, but even the Canadian Arctic, these little communities that need food, that have limited water and that have limited energy, diesel generators powering a place like Cambridge Bay,
mm-hmm.
you have to ship in all that diesel.
That's right.
Yeah, and I think such applications would probably bring in more money to actually do research on such stuff, because if it's a pure space applications, getting the grant for doing such research is way harder than finding an application that would be applicable here on Earth, can be used by anyone, anywhere on Earth, just appeals the masses, I would say.
Yeah, the European agency has this theme of life in space for life on Earth, and where you can make that connection often, this is very productive and sometimes even lucrative.
Mm-hmm.
And it's great because sometimes it really is true, and this is one of those cases where I think it's not a stretch to say that these technologies have a real use
mm-hmm.
for civilization on Earth.
Yeah, that's just it, absolutely. I mean, the entire human race is a much larger market than just human space exploration.
Yes.
And I mean, they're both very important, so it's really great to recognize those similarities and connections between the two.
As it stands, there are some 7 billion on Earth, and there are some 6 off. Not 6 billion, just 6. So, yeah, that's a bigger market.
Maximum, yeah.
Yeah.
Currently, we're looking to turn that around, of course.
Yeah, yeah. Well, if we can make this work.
Yeah, that's it. This is one of the big keys.
I'm kind of the whole time that he was talking about getting plants in the loop and talking about wheat and tomatoes and a few other things, little spicy type plants. It was interesting to see that there's already a bit of diversity, that you choose a bit which plant you want based on what the system is going to call for. But there's no species on Earth that cycles its resources in isolation from others. You have to think ecosystem level when you're thinking about the systems on Earth. And it's interesting to me to wonder whether these systems, as we get better at them, can be evolved to a point where there's multiple species in the loop, plants that help each other out, or where you have pollinators to go with your plants.
Right.
You know, do we need earthworms? Or is there even Earth if it's all hydroponic?
Yeah. Well, that's one of the things, actually, that we look at here at Western in the Biotron.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how familiar you are with the Biotron, but they have, like, guess you'd call them these chambers, where you can introduce different factors and see how different elements of ecosystems interact. And if you take out one aspect, take out the earthworms, mm-hmm. and see if you're able to introduce a different species in instead. So they kind of, one of the, I'm sure, many things that they look at is invasive species and what would happen there. So it's certainly a complicated problem. And this is one of the other places where we're looking into that. But I mean, we definitely don't have the answers to those sorts of questions.
That's cool, though. Ecosystem simulators? I like that.
I mean, it would be cool to see if this works here on Earth, cool to see that going in space, you know? I mean, they do a lot of this stuff he talked about at the ISS. Mm-hmm. Imagine, I was talking about sending to Mars. If you want to do this while you're away to Mars, you probably won't be able to take all the earthworms or all the, you know, factors needed for things to grow.
Yeah, you may have to define some minimal equipment list for an ecosystem.
Yeah, because, I mean, sending each pound or each kg of stuff up there is expensive. So finding a way to generate these plants and the food you need on limited resources is going to be one of the key things probably we need to know.
And there's probably not a single answer. There's probably a whole space of diversity of answers to this problem, depending on the case and depending on what it is you need to recycle and how long and where you're going. I suspect that there's an almost endless amount of work and optimization to be done on a problem like this.
Yeah. I remember watching this documentary about Neil deGrasse Tyson actually visited NASA to look how food is generated for a long term to be on ISS, and basically was testing stuff that is 6 months old or a year old to see how different it is. And from his looks, it looked like it was way different, and he wouldn't want to eat that after a year.
Oh, yeah, because that stuff gets uploaded well ahead of schedule.
Just even we are already thinking ahead of time. What if we have to go to Mars? Let's say next few years, how are we going to cope with that? But obviously studies like these actually help us to think about long-term space flights.
So that's a really interesting point that you bring up too, is the difference between the way they do food on the International Space Station right now with the pre-packaged dehydrated or freeze-dried foods that you just add water to. That's as complicated as it is for the space station, because without gravity to, you know, it's difficult to cook. So really this is one of their only options. But for planetary missions, for landing on a planetary surface where you have gravity and you have, I guess, a larger space to work with, you could do cooking. And just the human factors issues of how does it make a crew feel to rehydrate their food versus cook together. So actually, Matt Bamsey and I spent 4 months together in the Arctic doing a Mars mission simulation a few years ago, and this was one of the studies that we did, was a food study. So instead of just rehydrating food, we did cook our own meals and we took turns, and there was sort of a psychological aspect of this as well that was led by Kim Binstead, who's been doing food studies down at another Mars analog simulation site in Hawaii. But this is pretty cutting edge stuff to actually do these studies. I mean, it sounds intuitive that it's more enjoyable to cook your meals and eat fresh food that you've just harvested from your own greenhouse as opposed to adding water to astronaut ice cream or whatever. But but I mean, that's a big deal. The health and happiness of your crew is huge in terms of your overall mission success.
So. Oh yeah. And when I've done some military type work, you know, we found that food is a big part of morale.
Right?
You're doing a tough job in a tough environment, and you know, suddenly your spaceship smells like basil and garlic instead of a cold laboratory.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah. Well, when we were in the Arctic for 4 months, we took almost all of our food was shelf stable. It had to have the ability to stay stable for up to 2 years. So simulating what a 2-year Mars mission would be like, with the exception of some lettuce. We grew our own lettuce and our own sprouts. Mm-hmm. And it's true what they always say. I mean, it's just you gravitate towards those things you want. Sometimes you just find yourself staring at the lettuce.
Because you have a little green, living thing that's to take care of.
That's
right.
So it does help for morale, absolutely, as well as, and then you harvest it and eat it, and yet that doesn't seem too morbid after all. Treat it like your pet and then you eat it, but I mean, that's, it grows back, right?
It grows back, And hopefully it continues to grow with you and your mission throughout the length of it.
Yeah.
That's our show for this week. Western Worlds is a co-production of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration and Astronomy.fm. Western Worlds was created by John Moores. This episode was produced by Parshati Patel and Michael Forster, and featured an interview by co-host Raymond Francis. Our roundtable discussion featured co-hosts Melissa Battler, Parshati Patel, and Raymond Francis. Our editors were Anna Noon and Parshati Patel, and I'm Raymond Francis. Our theme music is Heliosheath by Sean Kim. You can continue the conversation online and listen to past episodes or learn more about Western Worlds by visiting our website at cpsx.uwo.ca/westernworlds. You can also email us at westernworlds@uwo.ca. On Twitter, we are at WWAFM, and on Facebook, we are facebook.com/westernworlds. On behalf of everyone here at Western Worlds, I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight. I hope you can once again make world enough in time to join us next week right here on astronomy.fm.